Okay, thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. First, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference and also of this program. I've been here during the last 2 weeks, and I really enjoyed the atmosphere here, which I found extremely stimulating. So today, I will actually talk about non-intersecting Brownian motions, and I will show you how this is related to a variety of models that you encounter in theoretical physics. Maybe I should say that it's not really my latest work on KPZ, but it turns out that my collaborators have been around in this program during the last weeks and just wanted to minimize the overlap of my talk with their talks. And so I decided to talk about this topic, which I thought could be interesting to the large audience of today. So this work was done with a few collaborators, and in particular with Satya Majumdar in Orsay, and also with Gino Baik, who is here. So what is it about? Well, today I will basically talk about one-dimensional non-intersecting Brownian motion. So you consider, say, a collection of n of them. And if you want to look at a plot of the in this time space direction, so typically, I mean, they have these non-intersecting trajectories. So these are Brownian motion conditioned on non-intersections. And in the following, I will be in particular particularly interested in these specific configurations, which I will call watermelons, just because of the shape they form. Which are actually non-intersecting Brownian bridges. A Brownian bridge is just one Brownian motion that starts at zero and ends up at zero on a unit time interval. And so you just consider a collection of non-intersecting Brownian bridges like this. And more interestingly, I will actually be mainly more interested in an additional conditioning, that is, I will consider this Brownian motions not only to intersect and to start and end at the same point, but in addition to stay positive. Okay, so these are actually non-intersecting Brownian excursions this time. So an excursion again is a Brownian excursion is conditioned to start and end at the same point and staying positive in between. Okay, so that's the kind of model that I will study, and in the physics literature at least, this is usually called the watermelons with a wall, and these non-intersecting Brownian excursions was in particular studied or introduced, I think, in the math literature by Craig Tracy and Whedon. So the first thing that one should have in mind that we should know about these collections of non-intersecting Brownian excursions is that they have an interesting connection with random matrix theory, which can be stated easily as follows. So if you look at this such a configuration, and if you look at a given time tau, and if you look at the positions of these excursions, then they are obviously random variables, and you ask what's the joint probability distribution of these guys at a given time tau. Okay, and this is a relatively easy computation that you can do. And if you do this computation, that's what you obtain up to a normalization factor. That's the expression that I wrote here. So you see that it actually resembles a lot the joint PDF that one usually encounters for the eigenvalues of random matrix theory. And more precisely, if you look at this xi over sigma of tau, so sigma of tau is just a simple dependence on time here, which is, by the way, symmetric around tau equal 1/2, as you would expect, because you are considering these excursions that come back to the origin. It turns out that they actually correspond to the one of the random matrix model in the Atlantian-Bauer classification, which corresponds to this Bogoliubov-Degen type of symmetry class. Another way to state that is that instead of, if you look at not xi, but xi square, then basically you end up with a joint probability of the Laguerre ensemble. Okay, so that's essentially similar. So you have, of course, a nice connection with random matrix theory. And the question that I would like to consider here is the following. I actually came to this problem from more or less from extreme value questions. And there are two natural extreme value questions that you may ask in this problem. The first one is, okay, if you look at these non-intersecting Brian motions, the first quantity that you might be interested in is the maximal height of the last excursion. So basically, you just look at this random variable hn, which is just the maximal height, so the top, the largest value of the top path reached on this time interval 0, 1. Okay, so that's the first observable, this hn. And another quantity that I would like to consider, and which you will see why it's interesting, is the time at which this maximum is reached. Okay, so basically this arc max of xn of t. So that means, again, what can be said? So the question that I really want to address is what can be said about the statistics of these two random variables. Obviously, you will notice that they are strongly correlated, and you will see how. But these are basically the two things that I want to address. And so first, I will deal with the maximum itself. So I will basically look at the marginal, if you want, and only consider this random variable. And in the second step, I will consider this joint distribution. And basically here, what I want to show you is that, okay, first one can obtain an exact expression for these quantities for any finite n. And then I will show you how one can do this large n asymptotics of this formula. And you will see why this is interesting. So the outline of my talk will be the following. So in the first part, I will actually just consider on the maximal height of the top path, and I will actually show how this is related to Yang-Mills theory. And you will also I will also see you that there is an underlying third order phase transition in this model. Then in the second part, I will actually really look at the large n limit of these formulas, and there you will see how this is related to KPZ, and in particular to directed polymers in random media. Then I will, if time permits, I will actually discuss a relation between a formula that we had obtained and another type of determinantal formula directly obtained from the RV2 process. I will introduce briefly what this RV2 process is, and then I will shortly conclude. Okay, so let's move on. And again, the quantity that I would like to compute is the probability that the maximal height is, say, between a given value h on the time interval 0, 1. Okay, so that's actually this cumulative, so that corresponds to the cumulative distribution of the maximum. So that's the probability that the maximum is, say, below a certain value, small h. Then you see that there is a relatively simple way to formulate the problem, because if you look at this quantity here, then basically that amounts to compute the probability that all your workers here start from 0, end at 1, and stay below this value h on the time interval 0, 1. Okay, so that's basically, you are actually considering this collection of paths in a bounded box of height h, basically. Now, if you are a physicist, it's quite tempting to look at these non-intersecting lines as the trajectories of fermions, and that's actually a very common way to do it, and that's the very useful way to do it, at least, and that's the way we proceed to do this computation. But, of course, if you don't like this fermion type of approach, I mean, of course, there are similar formulas in the mathematics literature, which are basically this Carlin-MacGregor formula, or the Gesell-Vienno formula for discrete lattice paths, which are basically the same. And that allows you eventually to compute this cumulative distribution. Just let me just mention one point, which has to be treated carefully, is that you see that here you want all these Brownian motions to start at zero, and then right after, of course, they have to be separated. So, of course, I mean, for Brownian motion, which is continuous both in space and time, this is a bit delicate to do, so there is you need to regularize this, what happens here at these points there, but this is perfectly, and there are standard ways to do that. Another way to do it is to start with discrete lattice path. I will maybe mention a word on this later on. So if you pursue this calculation, so if you really do this computation, that means if you consider that you have this fermion three fermions in this box. That's the formula that we obtained, which is written here. So you see that if you look at it here, so here I have a discrete sum over these integers ni's, and what I have to sum is something which looks pretty much like the joint distribution of eigenvalues of random matrices, except that here these ni's are actually discrete. Okay, so what I will eventually have to lead to deal with are essentially discrete Coulomb gas. That is, because of these interactions, I have indeed a Coulomb gas, but because of the discreteness, things are made, in some cases, in some limit, are actually quite different. So, indeed, this formula, you can also derive it. So we did this directly in the continuum, but you can actually also derive it. And this was done by Feyerl, who was a student of Christian Kratenthaler, directly starting from discrete lattice paths and then taking the continuum limit and showing that this is indeed the thing that you obtain. This was also rederived using Karlin MacGregor formula by Makoto Katori in Tokyo. So that's a formula that we obtained already quite some time ago. And for some time, we didn't know exactly what to do with it. But it turns out, and as we realized it with Satya Majumdar and Peter Forrester, we realized that exactly the same formula actually appears in a completely different context, namely in the context of Young-Mills theory. So let me just, I will not enter into the details of what Young-Mills theory is, but let me just give you the flavor of what it has to do with. So basically, let me consider what we call the Young-Mills theory on a two-dimensional manifold, say M, and with a given gauge group J. So this field theory is defined in terms of the central object, which is the gauge field A mu of X, which actually lives in the Lie algebra of J. So this is, in general, essentially a matrix. And so you can express it in terms of the generator of your Lie algebra, TA, if you wish. Now, from this A mu, you construct this object here, F mu nu, which is actually a quite fundamental object in these theories. And from this F mu nu, or more precisely from this quadratic form, you can actually write the partition function of this theory, which is here given by this path integral here over the field A mu there. Okay. Now, in principle, this theory is really defined on a continuum, on a continuum manifold. And as it is usually the case, if you really want to give a precise meaning to this partition function, and in particular to this measure here, so that means if you really want to define properly this path integral, what you have to do is to regularize your theory. That means a standard way to do that is to consider not a continuum manifold, but in fact a discretized version or regularization of this manifold by a lattice. So that's a standard way to do that, which was initially introduced by Migdal in the 70s, is basically to discretize your manifold here into polygons. So here I chose triangles. Now, these triangles are usually called plaquettes. And the idea is that on each link, on each edge of this plaquette here, you will actually put a matrix U, which actually belongs to the to this group J. So for instance, a unitary group, which is usually the simplest way to study. So basically, U is exponential of A, essentially. And now the idea is that you will define this partition function as this matrix. Now, these are actually matrix integrals. And you have actually here these products over plaquettes. So that means you decompose this full path integral in the product over these different plaquettes. And then you define some partition function associated to one plaquette. And more precisely, the partition function associated to this plaquette here is actually a function of this UP here. UP is actually what is called a Wilson loop. That means the product of this U along these edges. So I will not enter into the details of all this, but essentially once you have written these things like that, you have actually some degrees of freedom, because the only constraint that you really have at the end of the day is that this model here ends up in this ZM in the continuum limit. That is basically when the lattice spacing here goes to zero. So that gives you some freedom in the choice of this partition function here, ZP, associated to each plaquette. And the standard choice actually is what is called the Wilson's action, which is this quantity here, which was studied, introduced first by Wilson. I guess that many of you recognize actually this kind of matrix model, which actually enters in some directed polymer models. As it was shown by Gross, Witten, and independently by Wadia in the 80s, this model actually has an interesting phase transition as the parameter B is varied. And this, which separates, I will come back later to this, but this transition actually separates a weak coupling from a strong coupling phase. And this transition already turns out to be a third order phase transition, and I will come to this later on. Now, this choice of action was quite useful in the sense that it provides it can be solved exactly, but nevertheless it has one drawback, sort of, in the sense that it's not invariant under renormalization group transformations. So let me just be a bit more precise of with what I mean by renormalization group transformation. I mean actually an invariance under a decimation on one of these limbs here. So indeed, you could actually look for a specific choice of this partition function on a plaquette, which is such that when you fuse two plaquettes, say P1 and P2, so this fusion actually amounts to just integrate over this U3 here, which is the common link between these two plaquettes. So that's essentially this kind of operation that you would do. Then if you want to have something which is invariant under decimation, then you can impose that the resulting partition function of the full plaquette P1 plus P2 has exactly the same functional dependence as P1 and P2. Okay, so that's the standard way to implement some renormalization group transformation in this setup that I described here. Now it turns out that most of the action that you could imagine actually does not satisfy this relation. And in fact, you can easily check that this Wilson's action does not satisfy this recursion relation, which are called Migdal's recursion relation. But nevertheless, they can be solved, and they were solved explicitly by Rusakov in the 90s. And the expression is written here, and this actually, this ZP here, is known under the name of the heat kernel action. Now, the reason why this is the heat kernel action, so let me just tell you what these quantities that appear are. So this ZP here, you express it in terms as a sum over the irreducible representation of your group, J here, which is the gauge group. And then, so chi R here is just the character of your group evaluated for UP. DR is just the dimension of this representation, which is essentially chi R evaluated at unity. And then here you have this exponential. AP is simply the area of your plaquette. N is the number of color that you have in your model, so typically UN in this case. And C2 of R is just the Casimir operator associated to your group. So it turns out, so again, this is called this heat kernel action simply because, okay, maybe I will just write it on the both sides, but it turns out that this ZP of U, you can just write it under this form. This is AP. Oh, A. So this is simply this matrix element. Okay? So let me just write it there because probably people will not see that. OK. Okay, so dzp of u. So I just, I'm writing the same, and don't worry, so I'm not cheating. Okay, so you see that this zp here is just the matrix element of the heat kernel, in the sense that here, in the exponential, you have A, this is the area, so this is just this guy here. But this delta of J is just the Laplacian on your group. Okay, so that's actually, you see that, well, you can actually expand this on the characters, and the resulting character expansion is just this expression. So you already see somehow that there is some diffusion process behind this expression. Now, the other nice thing is that if you are able to now solve this model, because it satisfies this identity, then you see that you can really solve exactly the continuum model, right? Because of that, you can simply add as many plaquettes as you want and really cover perfectly your surface, and then eventually compute exactly the partition function directly for the continuum model. And so that was done in a rather great generality. Actually, you can compute this for the partition function for a given manifold of genus J, so that's what you would get. And in particular, if you just look at what happens on the sphere, so J equals 0, that's the expression that you get. Now, if you want to proceed and make a connection with what I was telling you about, and if you want even to analyze this partition function in the large N limit, it's actually quite useful to rewrite this sum over the irreducible representation in terms of the Young diagram. So I mean that you just label your these representations of J by the length of the corresponding Young diagrams. And as it was shown by Gross and Matitzin, if you take J equal UN, the expression that you obtain is actually this one. Okay, so that actually resembles quite a bit the expression that I showed you before for this non-intersecting Brownian motion problems, but not exactly. And if you want really to recover exactly the result that I showed you, you need to consider a slightly different group. And if you consider actually the symplectic group, SP2N, and this was done a little bit after Gross and Matitzin, that's the expression that you obtain. Okay? Now, if you look at this expression, this is exactly up to a prefactor, the expression that I showed you before, right? So that's the partition function of this Young-Mills theory on the sphere with the symplectic group. And that's the cumulative distribution of the maximal height of these non-intersecting excursions. Okay? Now, if you look at it, well, you see that there is indeed a direct correspondence. The main difference is essentially this prefactor here. And the reason is, of course, that this partition function, of course, doesn't have a true probabilistic interpretation. And if you want to give a good probabilistic interpretation, essentially you have to normalize it, and that's where this h to the power 2n squared plus n comes from. So you have this nice connection, which we sort of unveiled here with Peter Forrester and Satya Majumdar, and you can actually learn quite a few things about it. The first interesting thing that you can learn is that. You know, this model, this Young-Mills theory, it is known that they have actually a phase transition in the large N limit. And in this context, this is known under the name of the Douglas-Kazakov transition. So let me, this transition actually occurs as the area here of the plaquette is varied. Okay? So the area, sorry, of the manifold is varied. So let me just, so this is actually, just want to look. Let's look at this part of this slide. So this is the phase diagram of the Young-Mills theory. So you see that essentially, so this is in the plane NA. So you have this line here, this critical value, A equal to pi square. It actually separates this phase diagram into two regimes, a regime of large A, so large area, which is a regime of strong coupling, so for A larger than pi square, and the region of weak coupling on the left. Then, of course, this transition occurs only in a large N limit, so N goes to infinity limit, but for finite N, you will have a critical region which actually separates these two regimes. Now, in the language of the directed polymer, oh sorry, actually I made a mistake here. Should be, excuse me. This actually should be a recoupling for large A and stroke coupling for small a. Sorry about that. So now what you see is that because of this mapping between this Young-Mills theory and this problem of the height of the non-intersecting Brownian motion, you have actually this mapping. So basically, large h corresponds to small a, okay, because h squared is 1 over a, while the left tail actually corresponds to the strong coupling. So that means that at this value h, for h of order square root of 2n, in this model here, you have actually also a phase transition between the right tail, which is actually the weak coupling phase, and the left tail, which is indeed the strong coupling. Okay, fine. So now, what is the nature of this transition? Well, if you want to investigate the nature of this transition, what you have to compute is basically log of fn. So fn is like a partition function. Okay, you remember this was essentially this partition sum of a discrete Coulomb gas, and the natural object is then basically is the log of fn, right, which is the free energy. Now, if you rescale the things properly, that means if you divide it by this 1 over n square, log of fn, and if you rescale the things properly there, and take the limit n goes to infinity, what you see is that on the one side, this quantity will simply goes to 0, so that's the case where h tilde is larger than 1, while it actually goes to 1, so a non-trivial function, phi minus of h, in this other thing. Okay, so what I'm just doing here is I'm trying really to do the proper scaling, basically to understand the transition that happens exactly at this point. Okay. Now, if you want to understand the nature of this transition, what you need to know is to compute this phi minus of h close to h tilde. Okay, so when you reach this the transition point, you need to see how it does behave. And it's actually possible to compute this quantity following basically the method that Douglas and Kazakov had used for the UN case. We were able to carry out for the SP2N. You have to deal with some discrete Coulomb gas and some kind of saddle point calculation for the discrete Coulomb gas, which you can do explicitly. You can eventually express this phi minus of h in terms of some elliptic integral, so you have a fully explicit expression for this guy. I will not show it today because I want to show you something else. But the main point is that if you look at how it vanishes when h goes to 1, you see that actually that it vanishes with this cubic power. And this cubic power tells you that that means that the third derivative of this object, which I want to interpret as the partition function, is discontinuous at h tilde is equal to 1. Okay, so it's relatively uncommon phase transition that you encounter here in this kind of statistical models, but which turns out to be quite universal in this field of both random matrices. It turns out that a similar third-order phase transition occurs in a variety of random matrix models, and in particular in the Gaussian beta ensembles. If you put a wall there, then you can actually show that you have also a third-order phase transition as W is varied, very similar to this case. And more recently, we actually showed that there is also a similar third-order transition scenario which occurs for the KPZ universality class, and in particular for the KPZ equation itself. So this was done with Pierre Le Doussal and Satya Majumdar quite recently. Right, so now, as I said, this phase here is very well understood, right? So you can actually do this computation using this. I haven't shown you, but I told you that you can do this computation using this kind of discrete Coulomb gas. But of course, you also see that this approach doesn't tell you so much on the other way around. Okay? And in particular, you would also be able to say something about what happens at or close to the transition. Is there an interesting scaling regime around the transition? Now, to do that, there is a useful way to do this, which was initially introduced by David Gross and Matitsin in that paper of 1994. where they actually you introduce these discrete orthogonal polynomials. Well, you see that when you have such a, if I had instead of a discrete sum here, if I had just integrals, a usual way to evaluate this kind of multiple integrals is to introduce the orthogonal polynomials with respect to this measure here. Okay, and then once you have that, it's pretty easy to write the partition function in terms of the norms of these orthogonal polynomials. Now here you see you don't have an integrals, multiple integrals, but you have a multiple sums, discrete sums. So you can just do the same. That means instead of working with continuous measure here, you work with this discrete measure here, and you introduce these discrete orthogonal polynomials, pkn, pk prime of n, and they have to satisfy this orthogonality condition. Okay. And now what you really need to do is to study what these hks are, and in particular because it's relatively straightforward to show that this fn of h, you can again write it as this product over the norms, as you would do in standard with standard orthogonal polynomials. Now the question is, what do you do with these guys? Well, essentially, I will not really do it here, but you can do this analysis of these hks here along a line which was sketched by Gross and Matitsin by simply studying this three-term recursion relation. So that's what we did for these models. And we were able, at the end, to obtain a quite precise large n asymptotics for this quantity. So let me just remind or just make a brief summary of what the results are if you look at this distribution in the large n limit. So before I showed you this result, right, I showed you that this, if I take minus 1 over n squared log of fn, I had this function phi minus. So this was discussed before. Now, using this orthogonal polynomial technique, you can actually compute what happens on the right side. Now, on the right side, so that's actually the weak coupling limit, then what you get is exponential minus phi plus n times phi plus. So you see first a difference, n squared on the left, n on the right, which is something relatively common. Also in random matrix model, but the thing is that here you can actually compute explicitly this phi plus using these orthogonal polynomial techniques, which it's actually quite simple. And then you can you see that this regime actually they holds when you are far away from square root of 2n. So that means that when h minus square root of 2n is itself of order square root of n. Okay, so that means that you are still far away from the from this threshold. Now, what happens in the middle? Well, what happens in the middle is that if you do this, if you look at this orthogonal polynomial in the double scaling limit, which is really the one that you need to investigate to look at the vicinity of h close to square root of 2n with h minus square root of 2n of this order, n to the power minus 1 over 6, then you uncover that this function here, this f1, is actually the Tresidium distribution for GOE. So here we actually discussed this. We obtained this result again using this double scaling analysis of this discrete orthogonal polynomial. So you have here a scenario which is very similar to the one that you would expect that you find for the largest eigenvalue of random in random matrix theory. If you look at the left tail, you have something which decays like exponential minus n squared. While if you look at the other side, you have actually something that, so the right tail, instead, this case like exponential minus n. Now, you have roughly a way to understand why this this scaling here should be different. You see that in this non-intersecting line ensemble, if you really want to, have a typical height which is much smaller than the typical height, then you really have to compress this line ensembles. And what you can show is that the energy that it costs is precisely proportional to n squared. This is actually easily visible if you really look at this random matrix approach that I showed you before. Now, on the other hand, so that's why it costs you this exponential minus n squared. Now, on the other hand, if you really have If you just want to have a height which is much higher than the typical value, then you only need a single line to be very high, while the rest can be just at standard equilibrium, basically. Right. So that's actually, you can show that this actually costs you much less energy, and this is this weak coupling phase, where the energy to have such an excitation is actually proportional to n, and finally this means that this happens with probability exponential minus n. Okay, so again you have a kind of strong coupling phase where all the lines are really compressed, and a weak coupling phase, and this really corresponds to the weak coupling and strong coupling phase of this Douglas-Kazakov transition in Young-Mills theory, and then in between these two phases, so these two phases are actually connected by a Tracy-Widom distribution. Okay, so that's actually a scenario which we believe to be quite generic. Now, something that I would like to add here is that indeed we did this using a double scaling analysis, and this rigorous proof of this was actually first done by Carl Yeshti, and then by Carl Yeshti and Dong Wang, which proved rigorously our result. And something that I maybe mention, since there were a few mathematicians here, that there are actually also, as you probably know, there were also mathematicians who are interested in this Young-Mills theory, and in particular in France, there were these two people, Thierry Lévy and Mylène Maïda, who actually gave a proof of the existence of this Douglas-Kazakov transition, mathematical proof. Okay, following actually these ideas. Okay, well, I will not comment. I mean, this is basically what I illustrated in words for you. Right, so now let me move to these directed polymers and show you how this model actually turns out is related to directed polymers in random media. So if you look at this, if you look at these non-intersecting excursions, and let me look at what happens in the large n limit. Then it's relatively straightforward to see that in the large n limit, these lines here, they will basically have this kind of circular shape, which will be essentially deterministic. Leading term here will be proportional to square root of n, and it will be deterministic. But nevertheless, there will be fluctuations around these lines, around this top line, and these fluctuations turns actually are the order n to the power minus 1 over 6, as you would get from random matrix theory. Now, if you look at the typical fluctuations of the top path,